Tonight, we look at some of the practical ways through which we can grow in our emotional health. Let's start with this provocative illustration that's given by Sonia Lyubomirsky. She is a West Coast research psychologist out at the University of California. And she has this illustration which summarizes her research in this field, wherein she says that 50% of our happiness is due to genetics. And I am one to believe her on that, because I have seen some people that are just so disgustingly happy. And I say that because I'm jealous. I look at them and I'm just like, could you just give me a little bit of those genes, you know? I've tried several blood transfusions. It just doesn't work. But you see certain people that just have a kind of a happy, amiable mood, and other people like me and like you that are just not that way. Various different data back this up. Dr. David Lykin, he studied 410 monozygotic twins. So one monozygote. So these are identical twins, not dizygotic fraternal twins. And he found that these twins, over 9 years, separated at birth, correlated in their happiness with each other between 0.55 and 0.54. So totally different independent people correlating on the happiness scale. So whether they were sad, depressed people, or happy people, or just somewhere in the middle, genetics plays a huge role here. Lyubomirsky says that 10% of our happiness could be related to circumstances. Now, it's important to point out here, when she says percentages, this isn't supposed to be some kind of a strict rubric that, you know, somebody's going through a tragedy or grief. You say, well, only 10% of your happiness should be this grief that you're going through. That'd be very insensitive, very cruel. That's actually a misapplication of her data. What she's saying is statistically speaking, on a big group of people, if you had two different people and you put them in the same circumstance, really the circumstances don't change how those people would do. They would actually have very different, 90% different reactions to the same exact circumstances. That's her point. For us, we usually think it's 50% genetics and maybe 40% circumstances, and then maybe what's left over is our decisions. Lyubomirsky says that actually 40% is our intentional states of consciousness, or our intentional actions, what we choose to do. So far from being some kind of a negative picture here, I hope you can see this isn't a negative picture. This is actually a highly liberating picture, because it shows that we're not determined. You know, from a naturalistic worldview, you would have 50% nature, 50% nurture, or some combination of the two. That you're basically an electrochemical machine, a sociobiological machine, and basically how you feel is how you're programmed, or how you've been affected by causes which are antecedent or before you. And so you're just determined to be whatever you are. Lyubomirsky, interestingly enough, she says that she doesn't have a religious bone in her body, quote unquote. She's not a religious person, and yet she says 40% is given over to intentional actions. That when it comes to very happy people, one of the things you can see is that they're different in what they do, in what they think. And so we want to milk, we want to squeeze every last drop out of this 40% that we can here tonight. What are some areas to explore? Now, before I give you these areas, I just want to ask you the question. If you're here tonight and you're in a state of depression, and this is something that's lingering, and anxiety, loneliness, sadness, do you want to change? And then a follow-up question would be, how much do you want to change? You know, Jesus walked up to a man who was physically handicapped, and he said to that man, he said, do you wish to get well? John chapter 5, and you think to yourself, what a cruel thing to say to someone who had a physical disability. It was actually a very important question to ask. Do you want to get better? The number one factor when it comes to counseling and psychology is the drive, the motivation of the patient, the counselee. Their drive will actually determine whether or not they're going to get better. And of course, the counselor has something to do with that too and everything else, but we have to ask, do you want to change? Do you want to break free from this? And if the answer is yes, I got some ideas here. Now, I'm not saying you're going to like it. Like the first one here, exercise. I don't think too many of us like that. Exercise, but this is highly correlated with happiness. And to show you what exercise is like, I'm going to give you a slide that has a guy from the 1980s on it with a leotard that says, work it, which I thought was going to be funny, and apparently it wasn't. Embarrassing, but I'm going to keep going. Exercise helps with mood disorders. And we see this in the research right across the board. And these are recent studies, 2015, 2014. Helps with sleep disorders, both the quantity and the quality of sleep. The people who are into regular exercise, they feel better. They get better sleep. And as we've seen, sleep is connected all across the board. It's one of those multifactorial things. You know, it just spreads into all these different areas of life. And so anxiety, depression, sleep, exercise could be the key, one of the factors that could really lead to help. In a meta-analysis, again, we've been using these big terms, a meta-analysis is analyzing multiple different studies. In this case, 27 different studies were analyzed over a huge longitudinal period, 30 years. And they found 27 studies over 30 years that exercise reduced anxiety in 81% of cases. Now you're probably saying to yourself, well, what about the other 19%? The other 19% was at least supportive of lowering anxiety. So it was at least consistent with it. It was just too divergent that they felt they couldn't put that in. This could be in the upper 90s. Now, one of the keys to beating anxiety is just to get some movement, to break a sweat. A study of 1.2 million Americans, whoa, that's a huge sample size there, enormous. They found that exercise, now this is a double negative here, reduced poor mental health by 43%. So it improved mental health by 43%. Exercise. And we're not talking about anything extreme. I know some of us have those friends who are doing CrossFit and they're doing, you know, 850 burpees every day and, you know, lifting, you know, 400 pounds on their back and everything and, you know, breaking their spines in the process. And okay, that's cool if that's what you're into, but that's not what we're talking about here. We're talking about 45 minutes, 3 to 5 times per week. We can do this. They said here more exercise was actually not even better. There was no correlation. Optimal exercise, 45 minutes a week, 3, 4, 5 times a week. That's it. In fact, you see people that get into these real, somewhat neurotic behaviors of going to the gym 2, 3, 4 hours a day, and this doesn't help at all. Well, there's a certain point where it's actually too much. And when you think of exercise here, we're thinking of aerobic exercise, not to be confused with anaerobic. Anaerobic is where your pulse is at 80, 90% of what you can stand. Aerobic is just any kind of exercise for 45 minutes where it's kind of difficult to talk. So you could be on the bike. For some of us, it's going for a walk. Other people, it's a jog. Other people, it's a run. They can act. I don't know how they do these freakish people can run and have a conversation at the same time. I'm just like, I'm going to die. I'll go for a nice brisk walk. But this could be anything from exercise at your job. Maybe you're a tradesman. Maybe you're somebody who works with his or her hands and you're breaking a sweat. That's exercise. Of course that counts. Childcare. Maybe you're watching kids all day. Maybe you're a mother. Maybe you work with kids and you're chasing little children in 8 different directions. You know, we call that exercise, chasing children, housework. Maybe you go back to your house and you start to clean up for 45 minutes or an hour and you're breaking a sweat. So you just served all of your roommates and you also got a little bit of workout in. They said that the best exercises were team sports. That probably fits in with the social piece, which we've already looked at. Cycling, aerobic exercises, and gym exercise. So exercise, that could be the key. For some of you, you're like, you know, I'm just not into exercise. I'm not a gym rat. I'm not a weightlifter. I'm not a runner. And I'm not into exercise. I'm not into it. Well, if you suffer from depression and or anxiety, you are now. You just signed yourself up for a gym membership. To get into exercise, this could be one of the factors that could help you out. And you come to find that you really like it. You enjoy it. It feels good. To burn off some steam. Number two, it referred to cognitive distortions. So mental distortions of reality. Let me see if I can explain this simply. You think about going through the world, what we call life. And you walk through life and you have positive and negative and neutral events which happen to you every single day. Something positive happens. You know, you get the date and she decides she's going to go out with you. Something negative happens. She dumps you. Something positive happens. You get hired. Something negative happens. You get into a car accident. Something neutral happens. You watch the most recent Fast and Furious movie. Okay? It's like, it's not bad. It's not good. It's just meh. And that's the events of your life. They're positive, neutral, or negative. And yet these are filtered through your mind. Under this school of therapy, this is referred to as CBT, cognitive behavioral therapy. Cognitive. That the events of your life are filtered through your thinking. And as you think through these events, your thoughts are actually interpreting the data. This is what psychologists refer to as an internal dialogue, where you're thinking, what do I do with that? How do I explain that? What do I think about that? And from this produces emotions or feelings. Some people in this field, like Dr. David Burns, who is a pioneer in this field, he says that you don't have any feelings without an antecedent thought. So you don't have a feeling without a thought that comes before it. Thoughts always inform your feelings. That's pretty extreme. He might be right. He's all into this idea. He says we don't want to have, you know, cures that help us go from, you know, 100% fear down to, you know, 60. He's like, my goal is to take you from 100 down to 10, down to zero, to smash these false beliefs that you're having. Him and the Hulk, smashing false beliefs, killing them and saying that's not true. And once you smash them, the emotions go with it. Well, the emotions, well, we're thinking in terms of something that is hurtful to the person, which leads to suffering. And so suffering goes back into your life, and so we see a completed cycle. Events, and these are interpreted, and then there's emotions, and then there's suffering, and that's right back to life. For most of us, what we think falsely, not true, inaccurately, is that life produces emotions. That's not true. We think, well, I got a flat tire, and so I feel panicky, or I feel sad. No, life happened, and you had a thought, or two, or three, which produced an emotion, which produced the suffering. And so you're like, how am I going to remember this? Well, I turned it into an acrostic. Lies. Life, interpretation, emotion, and suffering. And so we're going to think about this, these cognitive distortions. These were developed by Aaron Beck and Albert Ellis back in the 50s. Well, David Burns was the one who took these from Ellis and Beck, and he turned these into things that, you know, normal people can understand. And he came up with this list. So if you see this list, it comes from Burns. Well, the first is all or nothing thinking. This is common with perfectionists. This would be the thought that either I'm going to get straight A's or I'm a failure who can't cut it. Somebody who's trying to lose some weight, they say, I ate a pint of ice cream and skipped the gym today. I'm never going to get in shape. You see the all or nothing thinking? For these kind of people, it's either 0 or 100. It's nothing in between. No shades of gray. Black and white, binary thinking. Somebody goes up to give a talk. I stuttered at the beginning of this talk. It's really funny. I stuttered for the first 5 minutes of my presentation. My talk was horrible. And so they see a part and they say, yeah, I screwed that part up. And so they project it over everything. So the whole talk was terrible. Well, this is toxic, poisonous thinking. This is the thinking which is holding you like shackles to your emotions. That every time you step out to do something, if it isn't completely perfect, which it never is, you feel like a complete failure. You feel like a loser. It's true, actually, that we always fail to some extent. When is the last time you did anything that was perfect? I mean, right on perfect. I can't think of a single thing. In fact, I get the pleasure of teaching you all every week. I don't know if you know this, but after these teachings, I go up there, I go to my car, I get in the car and I think back and I realize, man, God, I screwed that point up. I misnamed that other person. That didn't make any sense. And then what I do for you is I pray for you. What I pray is, God, that was my offering, imperfect, per usual. And I put that up on the altar and I just pray that you would do something with it. I pray the bad parts people would forget, and I pray the good parts you could use that somehow, because in reality, it's never perfect. This is an opportunity for those of us who are Christians that we need to be able to practice the grace of God, the forgiveness of God, the acceptance of God, that we know that when we go out to perform and do anything, we can't fail. We're under grace, we're under forgiveness and acceptance, and so just by virtue of the fact that we're getting out there to try, that's all we need to do. And if we get out there and try, that's enough. And even if we botch it 50, 60% of the way, God is still pleased. And really, this whole idea of all or nothing thinking, we don't see this anywhere in the universe. You know, you look at someone and you say, wow, she is a real brainiac. She is intelligent. But is she perfectly intelligent? You see somebody and you're like, he is not the sharpest knife in the drawer. And you're like, yeah, but is he completely stupid? Somebody who's beautiful. Wow, that woman, totally, you know, drop dead gorgeous. But is she perfectly, completely beautiful? Same thing with a guy, I guess. You know? Moving on. Negative filtering. This would be another cognitive distortion. You see what this is predicated on, the fact that we, like an illusionist, in our own mind, we have illusions that we trick ourselves with about reality. And we need to be able to see, oh, that's negative filtering. This is focusing on negatives, and this is where we filter out anything that's positive. For example, if there's a negative event, we say, I knew it. I knew it was going to be negative. I knew that was going to happen. A positive event happens. Things go well. And we say, it was a fluke. See, what did we just do there? Both events happened, and one of them we said, that confirms my theory, and the other, it just happened. It doesn't quite fit, but it's a fluke. This would be like a scientist who comes up with a hypothesis and has a confirmation bias, where whenever you give her evidence that supports her theory, she accepts it. And whenever you give her evidence that disconfirms her theory, she just rejects it, doesn't look at it. That's what negative filtering is. It's looking at your life, and you're only accepting the negative, and you're rejecting all of everything else. Here's a story from my life. I taught at one of these big teachings for our adults, and I had 30 people write out a positive comment card after the teaching. I was a young Bible teacher, and I just was reading through these, and it was just like so built up. But then there was that one negative one. Did you know that I can quote verbatim what was on that one negative card? I couldn't tell you what were on the other 30 at all, but that one negative one, I remember the words being used. It was, he is arrogant, and I didn't like his shirt. I'm like, man, you can really work on your negativity, man. Everyone makes fun of the way I dress. I mean, you can go deeper than that. My friends celebrate everyone's birthday, so it doesn't count. Oh, man, it's so amazing. They all, you know, brought a cake and got you stuff. Yeah, they do that for everybody, so it doesn't count. Negative filtering. They said that, but they were just saying it to be nice. See, this is basically filtering out. What this is doing is this is disqualifying the love and initiation of other people. When they do something which is negative, oh, that's tried and true. That's what they meant. I know that's their motive. They hate me. But when they do something loving or initiating, well, it's a fluke. It's out of the ordinary. I see through it. Dr. David Burns, he says, if you constantly throw cold water on the good things that happen, no wonder life seems damp and chilly to you. So true. Negative filtering. Then there's mind reading. This is when we have the cognitive distortion that we think that we know what others are thinking or feeling, usually about us.
Reach out to you all day. Are we on for tonight? Jeez.
Keegan's been texting me. Sorry, dude. Missed your texts. I assumed we'd meet at the bar. Whatever. I don't care.
Sorry, dude, missed your texts. I assumed we'd meet at the bar. Whatever, I don't care. Do you even want to hang out?
Do you even want to hang out? Oh, let's consider it. Like I said, whatever.
Like I said, whatever?
It's mind reading. You should watch the whole skit. It gets even worse. He comes in with a bat with nails sticking out of it. It's so funny. But this is kind of mind reading, isn't it? We're really assuming we know what people are thinking. Now, over text, that's really funny because we can't really pick up on nuance. But when it comes to actual relationships, we still do this. We do it quite a bit. How about somebody with social anxiety? They walk into a party of, 30, 40, 50 people and they say, everyone here knows how anxious I am just to be here. Socially anxious. My heart is beating like crazy. My voice is faltering. My hands are sweaty. Everyone here knows that I'm scared to death just to be sitting here. Or no one else at this party is anxious like I am. Okay, here's a question for you to think about. How could you possibly know what 50 people are thinking and feeling? You don't know that. They don't know what you're thinking. They don't know how you're feeling. And you don't know what they're thinking either. This is a cognitive distortion. It's a distortion of reality which isn't real. It's not real. They don't know. The person that thinks about you the most is you. Nobody cares about thinking about you as much as you do. What about this? Mind reading. Nobody really loves me. They just feel bad for me. How do you know that? How could you possibly know if people really love you? Why is she distracted when I'm speaking to her? She must think I'm boring. Huh? Or perhaps she was up late last night at the hospital with a loved one. How about that? How would that change your whole narrative? She was up late, she's exhausted, and now she's trying to listen to you, and she's, distracted and kind of tired. And you're a mind reader. Yeah, you're real special, so you know what she's thinking, and you know her whole history. You're omniscient, actually. You know everything. I'm the only one who doesn't get what the teacher is saying. How about that? And this basically turns into neurotic behaviors where people start to feel like I'm the only one. Nobody understands. What this does, in effect, is instead of moving toward other people, to figure out why were you distracted? Do other people feel the same way? Instead of creating connectivity with others, which is what it should cause us to do, it makes us withdraw from others. And all of a sudden you start to see a person and you're like, what is wrong with him? What happened to him? And he's withdrawing all of a sudden, and it's because he's assuming he knows what everybody thinks. Or it could cause counterattack, where we think somebody is jealous of me. And so now we start to talk poorly about the person. And so we withdraw or we attack when really this is an opportunity to connect. And essentially this becomes a self-fulfilling prophecy, where I start to think that everyone thinks I'm anxious or thinks that I'm stupid. And I'm the only one who doesn't get it. And then all of a sudden, that's how I start to act. Well, what do you think about that? Your thoughts are affecting your emotions, and then your emotions are becoming part and parcel with reality. Then there's fortune telling. This is another one for psychics. This says that negative predictions, we make these, and they are unjustified or they're magnified. For example, this airplane will crash. Fear of flying. How do you know that? Well, I just feel it. I can just sense that this air. So you are an aeronautical engineer, so you know that this is going to fall apart. You know that? No, I feel it. I feel it. Feel, huh? What are the facts? The odds of an airplane crashing are more than 1 in 5 million. That's equivalent to flying on an airplane every day for 14,000 years. We don't have enough lifetimes for this to actually come to fruition. No, I can sense it. I can feel it. Fortune telling. Wow, we should get you your own show on television. It's not true. It's not real. My loved one is going to die unexpectedly. You know that? How do you know that? Even if this is true, first of all, we're all going to die. Okay? We're all going to die. And Jesus Christ says that he holds the keys to death. He says, I am the resurrection and the life. John 11:25. But even if this is true, that a loved one is going to be taken away from you, is going to die, how does worry help? Jesus said, who among you from worrying has extended his life a single hour? How does worry even help that feeling that your loved one is going to die? In fact, most worries never happen. They've done research on this. Dr. Robert Leahy, he writes this in his book, The Worry Cure. He says, in one study, worriers were asked to write down their worries over a 2-week period and predict what would happen. Check this out. 85% of the actual outcomes were positive. So all the worries I've got for 2 weeks, what actually happened? 85% were good. Not bad. What about the rest? 79% of the rest of the 15%, the worriers coped with different negative outcomes better than they thought they would have. So 85% were good. Of the 15% remaining, 79%, they actually did better than they thought. So what this is saying, in effect, if you do the math, is only 3% of our worries come to fruition and they're bad. So we're spending time on the order of 97% of the things in our lives, worrying about them, and it's never going to happen. For the 3% that do happen, our worry didn't help anyways. What about this? I'm just always going to feel this way. I'm never going to conquer my depression or anxiety. Again, how do you know that? How do you know the future? That's a distortion. Repeatedly we see the change is not only possible, it's regular, it's consistent. Hopelessness is a hoax. That your feeling states that I'm just always going to be in this state. I'm always going to be depressed. I'm always going to be feeling anxious. I'm always going to feel worked up and panicky. It's not true. It's not real. That's a distortion. It's an illusion that you're believing from your own mind. According to an article published this year, is that hope is essential to change. This is a self-fulfilling prophecy. The thought that I'm never going to change, again, it's like the handcuffs on my hands that is stopping me from ever moving forward and changing. And it's actually false, but it's something that I'm believing is true. What we discover is, in fact, the mind can change the brain. What you think and what you do, now catch this, what you think and what you do will actually change the physical structure of your brain. Your mind changes the brain. Here's Jeffrey Schwartz. He was originally an atheist, and then he got into the study of neuroscience and this burgeoning field of what's called neuroplasticity. Mind, neuro, and plastic, that it's malleable, flexible, bendable. So your mind or your brain is flexible. And Schwartz was an atheist, so he didn't believe that, you know, your mind was separate from your brain. You don't have like a soul or anything like that. Your mind is your brain. Your thoughts are like brain gas. Your heart pumps blood. You know, your brain produces thoughts. Until he discovered that with patients with OCD, when he taught them to think differently, it changed the physical structure of their brains. You're like, what are you talking about here? After 2.5 months of this mutation of cognitive behavioral therapy from Schwartz, the brains of OCD patients, obsessive compulsive disorder, in this area of the brain, the RCD area territory, which is huge in patients with OCD, which creates a lot of the obsessiveness, the compulsiveness, this area of the brain, after 10 weeks, completely shrunk, no medication, only from this therapy of rethinking what they're doing. We discover this in London taxi drivers. How about that? These guys cruising around, they study them before and after. They find, I don't know if you've been to London, but in London, it's like spaghetti. The streets, they're just all over the place. It's kind of like Cleveland, man, only worse. And everyone's all over the place. And these London taxi drivers have to be able to know and memorize the best routes for everything. And they've studied that in the hippocampus, which is the visual spatial region of the brain, that these taxi drivers actually grew thicker neural layers, and they actually grew tissue in the brain. You're like, how can you do that? How can you know how to get across town like that? It's because after doing and thinking over and over and over, this actually changed the brain. Norman Doidge, neuroscientist, says that actually it's not your feeling. You could be feeling anxious. You could be feeling depressed. And yet acting against it. You know, you're doing some kind of a therapy, some kind of counseling. By the fact that you're acting against it, like maybe if you have obsessive compulsive disorder, you think your hands are dirty. Say. And you're thinking to yourself, I've got to clean my hands. I've got to wash my hands for the 70th time today. And by not doing it, even if you feel anxious, even if you feel worried, the not doing the action actually changes and rewires the brain. neurons that fire together, wire together. And mental traits become mental states. And so these two things work in harmony with one another. Well, then there's emotional reasoning. Under this view, this is the distortion that feel equals real. If I feel like something is real, then it is real. Like I'm feeling anxious, there must be something wrong. I feel alienated from her. We must be drifting apart. I've had so many people come up to me and say, I just feel so distant from you. I don't feel distant from you at all. I feel close as ever. Well, I feel that way. Well, it's not true, okay? We're okay, man. We're close. I'm really angry with you. You must have done something seriously offensive. I mean, that could be true, but under this view, there's no evidence. It's just I've got a feeling. I've got a feeling that this is true. I don't feel like getting started on that project. I'll wait until I feel like it. that was 7 years of college for me right there. Burns, he says, this plays a role in nearly all depressions or forms of depression because it doesn't occur to the person to challenge the validity of the perceptions that create their feelings. They feel and they don't ever think, what is the thought that's causing that? And is that thought true or false? Then finally, there's mislabeling. Mislabeling is where we start to identify ourselves or others by our failures. So instead of saying to somebody, I lied, we say, I am a liar. You see the distinction? One is in what you did, cognitive behavioral therapy, what you think and what you do. One thing is I did, I lied. The other is I myself am a liar. Or I did worse than anyone else on that test. I'm such an idiot. I am an idiot. He is so stupid. He's such an idiot. She is so childish. Not that he did something foolish, but that he himself is stupid. Well, people are more complex than one identity. Think about a person, even a person you don't really like that much. They're way more complex than identifying them with one identity. And moreover, if you're a Christian, the Bible says that whoever has come to know Jesus Christ is a new creation. We should no longer judge people according to outward appearance. Just like I know that God accepts me and my identity with him. I'm supposed to identify other people that way. And again, you know what this comes to? This comes to a self-fulfilling prophecy. Because if I think I'm an idiot, I'm going to start to act like an idiot. If I think he's so stupid, I'm going to start to treat him like he's so stupid. If I think that she's really infantile, well, then I'm going to start to treat her like she's infantile. And this whole thing is a negative pinwheel that is just completely destructive to people. Well, number three, what else can we squeeze out of this 40%? Transcendent meaning. By this, we don't mean that you have a meaning in life because it's a subjective thing, like you like to do a certain hobby, something that makes you, the subject, feel good. We mean by this that there is an objective meaning, that it's like transcendent, it's like above us. And those who connect to this, some kind of an objective transcendent meaning, changes their emotional health. This is referred to as logotherapy by Viktor Frankl. He was an Auschwitz survivor back during the Holocaust, and he got out, got his PhD, and his contention was that people, their fundamental need is that they lack meaning in life. And if they knew that there was a meaning behind what was happening, even in Auschwitz, this is a man speaking from experience now, even in the worst suffering, if we knew that there was a meaning behind this, that we could suffer and persevere through almost anything. Just think about this for a second. A lot of people think to themselves, do I have a meaning? I mean, look at a beach, for example. If I was to go up to that beach and take one of those grains of sand off the beach, would it really matter? I don't see how. I mean, it just doesn't seem like it would change that beach at all because there's billions of them on that beach. Well, what about this beach here? What if one of those people in the Buckeye Stadium, the horseshoe, was just plucked out? What did it really matter? What if we extended that to 7.7 billion people? What if one of them was missing? Would it really matter? Oh, you could see how this would affect your emotional life if you don't feel like you have a meaning. And in fact, the literature supports this. Those who reported, quote, highly meaningful lives reported a 30% reduction in mortality. They were able to endure when they felt like there's hope, there's purpose. Writing out your values is an incredibly powerful practice to sit for a little bit and write out, what am I living for? What is most important to me? And to write this out and say, where am I heading? Not even goals, just your values. What do you think is meaningful? What do I want for my life? Incredibly powerful. Kelly McGonigal out of Stanford, she says, writing about your values is one of the most effective psychological interventions ever studied. Writing about values has been shown to boost GPAs, reduce doctor visits, improve mental health, and help with everything from weight loss to quitting smoking and reducing problem drinking. It helps people persevere in the face of discrimination and reduces self-handicapping. In many cases, these benefits are a result of a one-time mindset intervention. People who write about their values once for 10 minutes show benefits months or even years later. Wouldn't you like to be the kind of person that no matter what's happening in the world, you're not held hostage? Because you've got values. You've got a transcendent meaning to life, a purpose. And when you suffer, of course you're going to suffer. Obviously you're going to suffer because I have values. I've got a meaning here. I got purpose. And so that means that I'm going to expect that. And when that happens, I'm going to confront it versus the person who is spineless, who doesn't have any values. This is the person who, whenever they come up against some kind of a bad word, a confrontation, they just feel like, you know, they're silly putty. They fall apart at the seams. Well, as we wrap up here tonight, let me just leave you with a couple thoughts. When we talk to each other, when we try and counsel each other, help each other, speak to each other, a lot of times people think, you know, when they share their feelings with each other, you know, that was a really cool time together. And it is. It is. To be able to open up about how you're feeling is important. But it isn't as important as our thoughts. When I share how I'm feeling, you know, I'm sad, I'm anxious, I'm depressed. That's one thing. But for me to say, I'm insecure, I'm jealous, I think that I'm going to die if I go out and do that. When we start to really get under the hood to the thought structures, the cognitive distortions, the false beliefs, this is where true vulnerability really happens because we're acknowledging what's real. And I guess I would just ask you, what is one cognitive distortion that stood out to you? Maybe one of these, as we were reading through them and describing them, you're like, that's me. Which one? If one of them jumped out to you, this would be a good time to open up with somebody about that and say, hey, I'm really thinking about this, or I'm feeling this and I don't know why. Finally, do you feel the emptiness, the boredom, and the lack of meaning in your life? Well, there's good reason for thinking that. You know, we're one of 7 billion people out here. Where is there meaning? According to the Bible, there is meaning for two reasons. Because God made us in his image. He made us like him. And Jesus Christ died for every single man, woman, boy, and girl on planet Earth. So that's something that's objectively true and truly important. And because of that, we have true meaning, real meaning, that I don't need to just think to myself that I'm a meaningful person or what I'm doing is important. To have the creator of the entire world say, I love you and I accept you. How does that compare to 7 billion people that are broken like me? Why do I need their acceptance, their meaning? To have God come into your life and to say, there's meaning because I'm here. That's true meaning. And maybe you've had that sense of angst, that sense of boredom, that void. That could be because you haven't personally received Jesus Christ into your life. Well, you could do that here with us tonight. Just call out to God in prayer and just say, I want what Jesus did to come for me. And this could be the first step toward a totally new life of happiness, joy, and love that you can't even experience right now.